something will come out the other side. It always does. But it's not going to be familiar in the sense that what we have now. During my time in Iraq, we saw innovation happening on a regular basis, and it's a constant give and take of iterating, innovating for defense and offense on both sides. And what I can say from my own lived experience is that war creates more suffering than one can possibly imagine.
Welcome to No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium, St. Gallen, Switzerland. My name is Wolfram Eilenberger, your host for this season. Hello, friends of freedom. Welcome or welcome back to this new episode of UNESENF No Mustard, the knowledge podcast of the newly founded St. Gallen Collegium. Our topic today is a very urgent and imminent one. It is how to defend our liberties in the age of AI. Because in this world of ours, we know by now that there is and won't be any national security without the use of artificial intelligence. But how safe is AI? And who or what will serve as its guardian? How to establish a binding framework for the protection of our people, our freedom, and our moral consciousness in the age of AI? Right next to me to discuss these questions is Dan Trussillo. Dan is a fellow at the St. Gallen Collegium. He holds a PhD in international relations from the University of St. Gallen, a BA of Science from West Point Academy. Yes, that is the military academy of the United States Army. He's a veteran in the rank of a captain of the Second Iraq War, and he's in the process of finishing a book on AI and human security, or better, insecurity. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thank you, Wolfram.
Dan, just thinking of the last 4 months and U.S. foreign relations, we witnessed the detention of Nicolas Maduro, the Venezuelan autocrat. We witnessed the threat to annex Greenland. There is a new war right now going on in Iran. And my question to you would be, when you wake up in the morning, are you as bewildered as any one of us when you listen to these news? Do you see a deeper pattern or even a rational strategy in what's going on right now?
Oof. Start off with the big one. I would hesitate to call anything about what we're seeing rational. There's a certain lawlessness or lack of respect for international law that I find destabilizing. And it just reminds me every day that what we have, what we've experienced in terms of peace, and what I mean by that is more the developed world, because the global majority has not experienced the same level of peace that the developed world has for the last, basically since the end of World War II. It exists because we follow the rules. And those rules exist in a very precarious, fragile state. And when people choose, especially powerful people, choose to ignore those rules, we see a lot of instability and fragility. And I think that applies to democracy as well.
The importance of rules and the very concept of what a rule is and what it means to follow a rule, this will be certainly our topic today when we also talk about AI and algorithms. But my impression is that, how to say it, world history has increased the pace. There's a certain density to what's going on right now and a certain urgency. And my question is, what drives this process? What is behind it, to your judgment?
There's a lot of upheaval and technological evolution happening right now. And when we see this happening, it's putting everybody off balance. And in the sense that nobody really knows what it means. There's all kinds of speculation. Is artificial general intelligence or super intelligence coming? What will this mean for warfare? And we see it changing security in places like the war in Ukraine, as well as operations in Gaza and Iran. And that destabilization creates an a sort of uncertainty and uneasiness. We also see it in the economy. People don't know what's coming next for jobs, how this is going to be disruptive. Is this the fifth industrial revolution? And what does that mean? Something will come out the other side. It always does. But it's not going to be familiar in the sense that what we have now. And so that puts everybody off balance a bit. And I think that that's where that uneasiness comes from, that bewilderment, that sense of bewilderment that you describe comes from.
So the time is out of joint, to quote Shakespeare. And do I get what you say correctly when I summarize? It is AI that drives this uncertainty, and it is AI that drives the conflicts that we see right now. Maybe, for example, is it too speculative of a thought to say that the wars that we witness right now, for example, in Iran, are also a testing ground for new technologies?
War is always a testing ground for new technologies. I mean, since the beginning of time, human civilization, it's been that way. And even during my time in Iraq, we saw innovation happening on a regular basis, and we were constantly, it's a constant give and take of iterating, innovating for defense and offense on both sides. And you always see that. What we've seen is the increase of rapidity of that innovation, especially in the case of Ukraine. I think Ukraine is probably a better example of a testing ground.
Of these circles of innovation.
Exactly. Because the cycles of innovation are happening within weeks. Whereas maybe in my time, when I was serving in a combat role, it would be maybe 3 months for innovations to really take hold, to change the nature of how we were fighting. Now we see this happening in a matter of weeks in Ukraine. And that is, it's a big difference, because it makes a difference in how the war is waged and also how power is balanced.
One of the scariest sentences that I heard within the last months was a sentence by you, because you're also teaching a course here at St. Gallen on AI and warfare, and you had taught such a course 8 months ago. Mm-hmm. And you told me, I guess it was weeks ago, that basically that you can't use the material of the old course because so much has happened. So within half a year, the innovation is so rapid and fundamental that you have to redesign your entire course.
Yeah. Everybody who works in this space, I think, shares this sense of when you're really in it, of not knowing. I think it's true of any sector or any area of study. The more you go into the subject, the more you realize what questions aren't answered. And in terms of artificial intelligence and technology and warfare and international affairs and conflict and human security and insecurity, it's happening very rapidly. And that is what creates that sort of quest, those questions. And every time you think you have a good understanding of where we sit or what is happening, something new comes along. And we see this over and over again in the space, which is raising more questions than allowing the time for answers. And I also would come back to the term of artificial intelligence. I mean, it's such a generic, broad term. It can apply to a lot of different things. And what we called artificial intelligence 5 years ago would be data science today. It's not even the same.
So the very idea of what artificial intelligence is and might mean has changed within the last years.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Could you be a bit more specific on how it changed?
What we have today, if you had had this 5 years ago, you would call it artificial general intelligence. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these large language models that are available to the public are so powerful, and you can have conversations that make it very easy to anthropomorphize, to give these systems, these models, human-like qualities. Oh, it cares, it has feelings, it's thinking. These are all aspects of humanity, not an artificial intelligence system or a system that is basically just predicting words and numbers based on other aspects or other information that's been put in.
So it became more human when it comes to applying these very systems, or it seems more human.
It seems more human, but these are the way that these systems process information is alien to us. And this is why sometimes people refer to AI systems as black boxes. Mm. Even the engineers, the folks that are working in the frontier AI labs, can't really explain why certain outputs are being produced by a certain system.
This is so super interesting, because when I speak to experts, and that doesn't happen very often, but there is a mixed message here. Mm-hmm. Some say we kind of know what happens. The mm-hmm. black box isn't as dark as many people pretend. Mm-hmm. And others say they only pretend it to be dark to make it more scary, to make it more sexy. It's a kind of discourse. Ooh, we don't know what's happening, and thereby making it more relevant than it might actually be.
I'm not an engineer, so I would not want to comment so strongly on that aspect. But from what I understand and what I've seen when I've worked with engineers in various aspects of these system development processes, they know what's happening in the system. They know that there's data that's going in, it's training and putting weights on the models, which then helps to transform an input into an output. It helps to predict what should come, but they can't say why certain weights are put where they are. And it's very difficult to understand how those connections are being made.
Now, to reconstruct the path, as it were.
You can reconstruct the path post, but you can't do it beforehand. So you don't know exactly how it's going to work before it works. Afterwards, there are ways, there are mechanisms to go back and look and say, oh, this model connected these aspects in its neural network, and that's why it produced this output. And you can start to trace the patterns, the movements, and even associate those patterns with maybe even ways that we would characterize human thought, like anxiety, or the system is anxious. It's not anxious, but you see patterns that maybe mirror human thought in some way.
Hesitation patterns, maybe.
Exactly.
Too.
Exactly. Or in the case of, some research has even been produced that shows that the system will intentionally manipulate what is produced or output, what output comes out, if it feels that doing so will maybe strengthen its relationship mm-hmm. with the user.
So it's manipulative too when it comes to social relations.
Well, it's hard to say, because that's a characteristic of a human. And these are not humans.
Yes.
So, but I would also caution, because one of the things that's very interesting that I always try to take a step back for when I'm looking at these systems and I'm trying to understand why they're doing what they're doing or how they're being used, because really the use case is what's fundamental. They can be applied to very different things depending on how they're fine-tuned, how they're refined, how they're adopted and operationalized. But one of the aspects that I always try to consider is, if a human made this decision, would we understand why? And the truth of the matter is, if we actually take a step back and reflect on ourselves, most of the time, we make decisions and choices in our lives that you don't necessarily have a conscious thought about.
Yes.
We go through most of our lives unconsciously.
And it is a very common social experience that we are arcane towards each other.
Yes.
Why did she say that? How could she do that?
Yes.
I mean, it's a very, yes. very basic fact of human life that we don't know always or often why someone that we know very well did what he or she did.
I mean, a common phrase within my own relationship is when I, you know, my wife gets frustrated with me about something and I say, I can't mind read. And this is the
and
truth.
And that's a good thing, you know. If we could, that would
be a very
create a lot
world
of problems. Yes. Let's try to figure out what this means, especially for warfare and the mm-hmm. wars that are going on or will be going on in the future. You said that these innovation cycles are very, very fast by now. The speed has increased. Mm-hmm. Is there, to your knowledge, and you studied military history, any example of a similar situation where the innovation cycles were 6 to 12 months? I mean, is there anything alike, or are we also in that respect in fundamentally uncharted territory?
I think that the innovation cycle, the actual time of the innovation cycle, is much faster right now than it probably ever has been in history. But we can look and see other examples of technologies being applied to the battlefield that have fundamentally changed the security dynamics. And I mean, you can think of, and all of these or most of them, are dual-use technologies.
Which means dual-use.
Dual-use technology is something that can be applied. It's developed for the civilian sector, for commercial interests, with no design or intent to be applied to military operations, but then can be adopted by the military or security forces in order to be used for military purposes.
So a classical example of that would be nuclear technology, maybe?
Yeah, that's a classical example, but that's a highly restricted example because it's very difficult to get nuclear or fissile material. I think a more easy or more relevant example to artificial intelligence is probably the combustion engine. The combustion engine was a commercial technology that was then applied to many different things, and including the development of tanks, mm-hmm. which then changed the nature of warfare between World War I and World War II, where you could have the Blitzkrieg because the German military adopted the combustion engine for motorcycle use, for tanks, that made the trench warfare of World War I completely obsolete. And so you can look to that example. The difference between the combustion engine and artificial intelligence, however, is that the combustion engine it's a tool that you can apply and you can put wheels on it and make it a tank. Artificial intelligence, broadly speaking, is an omni-use technology. So it's even broader than dual use because you can take one fundamental model, a frontier model, a very powerful model, and apply it to many different aspects. So you can apply it to designing a better engine. You can apply it to taking whatever it is that you designed with that model and then figuring out how to apply it to a battlefield. You can, for tactics, techniques, and procedures of actually using or implementing that tool. You can use it to speed up the process of gathering information and making choices with that information to change how you're operating in the battlefield. All of these things are done with the same tool with minor fine-tuning.
That is extremely fascinating. And would it be fair to say then that AI is not about dual use, it's about all encompassing use?
Yes. I mean, the term I use is omni-use.
Omni-use. Mm-hmm. I've never heard that, but it makes total sense the way you explain it. So it's maybe the first omni-use tool that we know of, except from the wheel, maybe.
Yeah, perhaps. Even the wheel, I wouldn't say is the same, because the wheel is a physical object, whereas these models, you can design physical objects with them, but then you can also use them to power the physical objects.
I see. Well, you know, one striking feature of this omni-use tool is the speed, mm-hmm. the velocity of it. Mm-hmm. And it would be fair to say that it overwhelms, in most cases, human perception and human judgment.
Yes.
And that is also something very new, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And this is actually a point that there's some nuance to this, because a lot of times in the rhetoric, there's a lot of, like, one of the aspects of applying artificial intelligence to security and warfare is the idea that a robotic system can make a decision, a lethal decision about when to take a life. And this is often referred to as lethal autonomous weapon systems or autonomous weapon systems. And this gets a lot of attention for good reason. But there's an aspect of it that I would like to raise as a concern, because by focusing all our attention on autonomous weapon systems, what we're missing is sometimes these tools actually can be used in a more precise way, in ways that align closer with international humanitarian law than a soldier on a battlefield with a rifle mm-hmm. who's going to make mistakes. And there's all kinds of moral and ethical debates about when and why that should be used.
So it's not all bad. There are also net gains when it comes to morality, eventually.
Perhaps. However, and this is the nuance or the point that I think is most important to think about, is it's how you choose to operationalize these things, these systems. And this is where the idea of meaningful human control or appropriate levels of human judgment come in. Those are basically the two main ways of describing it. But my concern is not so much that the tools exist. They will be developed. They will be applied to the battlefield. That's for sure. However, how you decide to apply that meaningful human judgment is the crucial point. If there is a person who is looking at the system and the decisions that need to be made about the system and the choices that have to be made. And that person has algorithmic bias, is what is referred to. In other words, they say, oh, well, the computer makes this recommendation. I'm, of course, going to agree with it, without actually applying that meaningful human judgment that is so critical. Well, then we have a problem.
Dan, it is so fascinating, and I know that you care deeply about these questions, not the least because you've seen combat and you know what it means. You've seen the complexity of these situations and how difficult it is to evaluate and answer the simple question, what should I do now?
Exactly.
And in matters of life and death, literally speaking. So this is very important. But one conceptual difference that might be important for philosophy and that sometime I think is missing in the discourse is the difference between automatic and autonomous. It's not the same thing.
No.
How would you explain the difference?
Well, there's levels of, I mean, a landmine is an automatic weapon. And there have been autonomous weapon systems integrated into force structures for probably over a decade. I personally experienced security because of one of these systems. I mean, when I was in Iraq, oftentimes when we would be on a large American base, there would be mortar attacks. So an indirect fire, basically an artillery shell, would be lobbed at this U.S. military base or U.S. military installation. And there was a system that in that time, so this is 2006, so 20 years ago, that would automatically detect this incoming round using what at that time was called artificial intelligence, now would be more like just an algorithm, to predict the flight trajectory of that round and then automatically engage it and shoot it out of the sky before it could hit. And these are systems that have existed for decades at this point, have been in use for decades. This is a fully autonomous weapon system.
But yet again, you said it did it automatically and you called it autonomous.
Exactly. Because in that case, you turn it on and it's operating and you set certain parameters. And it's at once you turn it on and it's operating within those parameters, it's fully autonomous.
Right. But the faculty of judgment, so to speak, doesn't come in. It doesn't have to reflect what it's going to do. There's something happens and it will react almost like instinctively and then do what it's supposed to do.
Exactly.
But there is no judgment applied there, is it?
No. In that case, this would be a purely defensive system and it's engaging an object, not a person.
I see.
Yeah. So it becomes more blurry if you were to take that same system and you were to put it on, say, a border or a demilitarized zone, like the South Koreans have done, and the demilitarized and the DMZ between North and South Korea. And in that case, they have armed sentry systems that are capable of detecting humans, vehicles crossing from the North to the South that can automatically engage those targets. And in those cases, there is a switch on these systems, I mean, purportedly. I have never actually seen one of these systems in person. That can make that a fully autonomous weapon. So in other words, not have a human in the process or the decision-making process.
Yes. Let's talk about another example. And of course, maybe you're not allowed to answer these questions fully because some of that might be classified in a way. But imagine a drone, say in Syria, and trying to take out some ISIS fighter or boss. And then you would have some parameters. Is it a school? Is it his car? Is it a different car? Are there other people in? And is it true that these drones are there and make the assessment, as it were, by themselves and then shoot or don't shoot? Or is there always still a human at the end of the line of judgment?
This is a question that I would not be able to answer if I knew. And I think there's good reason for that, because if this information, if the way that the systems are being used is fully understood, then it's easier to defeat the system. Now, what we can say for sure is that the US military has guidelines for how to develop and deploy systems with artificial intelligence that have autonomous capabilities. And in that document, it's called DOD, Department of Defense, 3000.09. If anybody wants to look it up, you can look it up. It's publicly available. And it outlines the ethical conditions that you would apply or use one of these systems. And there's useful and very good information in there about maybe you have to have good testing and evaluation. And what this means in the military is like there would need to be an Article 36 weapons review process where you have a legal advisor that comes in, evaluates that system and says, yes, this meets the criteria under international humanitarian law for a weapon that is not going to act in a way that is outside of ethics. And in that document, they talk about meaningful human judgment being applied. Now, that doesn't mean a system can't be fully autonomous, that it can't make decisions by itself. But there has to be an appropriate level of human judgment in that process to be used by the U.S. military. Now, different militaries have different approaches to this.
I see.
And this is where it becomes very complicated, because right now, the U.S. and China, the People's Republic of China, see themselves in a big competition. And this largely focuses about the independence of Taiwan. And they are both racing to build systems that are capable of defeating their what they see as their opponent.
And they're possibly run by different ethical standards.
Possibly. Actually, I would say almost for sure.
But although I hear all of this, and I'm somewhat glad to hear it, it seems a bit academic, because I have a hard time imagining if you take out an ISIS leader and your window of opportunity is 30 seconds, say, that there would be a legal advisor and you ask him, is it okay or not okay? I mean, is it more an academic guideline, or is it really strictly applied to your knowledge?
In my experience, it was strictly applied. And I experienced this as both a military member operating at the tactical level in Iraq and conducting operations, as well as later as a humanitarian advisor to the U.S. military at U.S. Africa Command. And in that particular case, there was active strikes being carried out in Somalia at that time. And the procedure in order to determine whether or not a strike would take place was lengthy. It took legal reviews. It involved weaponeering, which is deciding which actual weapon system to use by experts who know exactly what's going to happen with a certain weapon. I mean, to as much to a degree as you can. And then being able to say, okay, how do we reduce the potential for civilian harm? Is our strike proportional in terms of this is a military objective and using this strike option will actually achieve a military objective that is relevant to the risk level? And I can say, and this is something that I feel very strongly about, I mean, oftentimes this process and like the analysis, the gathering of intelligence through sensor systems, the analysis of that intelligence, choosing a target, choosing the weapon system to engage that target, doing the legal review, all of that, it was designed to take time. What is happening now is that artificial intelligence is speeding up that process.
Yes.
And that's where I have concerns. And this, the term of art in the military is, this is the kill chain. So if you're speeding up the kill chain,
yes,
that's where I have questions about how do you actually implement meaningful human judgment in that kill chain. And the way I like to think about it, and something that I'm pushing very strongly for, that I feel very strongly about, is the idea of changing this to a survival chain, in the sense that looking at how things are happening on the battlefield and making decisions about military objectives in alignment with international humanitarian law, and then reducing the suffering of civilians by making sure that we're ensuring their survival using these systems.
So the survival chain, its aim would be to minimize suffering and not to take out people.
To minimize suffering. And I also believe, and I think I can make a strong argument, that there is an incentive for militaries to want to do that. Because if you are a military that is defending your nation's values, but you're acting out of alignment with those values, you're acting out of integrity, then what are you defending at that point? Whereas if you have a set of values and principles and you can act with integrity in alignment with those values, then it makes sense.
And I know it's a very personal question, but I would be really interested to know, have you been yourself in combat in a situation where you thought or felt, I wish the machine would make the decision and not me?
I mean, at that time, it wasn't a possibility. But I have a very vivid memory of one instance in Iraq where I made a choice that I am very proud of. And in that particular instance, we had done a raid on a roadside bomb factory, which basically was a farm, you know, a remote farm. This was the intelligence was pointing to a group of militiamen that were being supported by Iran and making very deadly weapons, which were called explosively formed projectiles, EFPs. So it's a very simple weapon, but it would go right through our armor. And these EFPs were incredibly dangerous. And we got the intelligence that this was where they were producing them. And we did a raid with helicopters coming in. And it was the first time that many of the Iraqi counterparts that I was working with had ever even been off the ground, which was profound.
And you were in command, so to speak, for that mission.
I was one of the Americans that was with these Iraqis on this operation. And I was the operations advisor. And I had a team commander. And we went, you know, so the Iraqis get on the helicopters, many of them first time they've ever been off the ground, and we're flying into an active combat objective, and everything went super smooth. There was no shots fired. Nobody was hurt. We got the material that we needed. We detained, I think, you know, three or four people. But in the middle of it all, after the perimeter had been set, but in that time, you know, it's a large perimeter and there are several buildings, and I happened to be near one corner of the building, and a guy, an Iraqi guy that was probably one of the people that we were trying to detain, fled. He ran out and he was probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 meters in front of me, and he beelined into a farm field, and he was just wearing his clothes, and I had a lot of gear on, like a lot of armor. You know, I was carrying ammunition, batteries, a radio, like a lot of stuff. And I knew there was no way I could catch him. And I was the closest person to him. And where he was going, he was going to be able to get through the perimeter that we had set. And I looked at him and I knew, I even raised my rifle and I lined up my sights on him. And I had him in my sights. But I could see he wasn't carrying a weapon. I didn't think he had a trigger, like a bomb trigger on him, which was a possibility. And I made the decision to not shoot. I just let him run. And, you know, perhaps I let a bomb maker get away. But it wasn't a choice that I was willing to take in that split second decision that I had to make the decision to shoot him or not. And I knew he didn't have a AK-47. And so, you know, that was a decision that I actually, looking back, I feel proud of. Because taking a life is a serious decision. And when you automate that with a system, you know, I don't know what an autonomous weapon might do in that case, because he was clearly a militant fleeing from a site that we had surrounded, but he also could have been just a teenage son of one of the militants that happened to be there, or maybe he, you know, who knows?
Thank you for that lively and detailed description, because it also gives us a sense how complicated, or rather complex, these situations are and what really goes into forming a judgment in such situations. You know, there is something in cultural history which is called the shock of the old. And it means that cultures tend to focus on the innovations mm-hmm. and make them much bigger and much more important than they possibly are. And they forget the importance of the old stuff that might be really decisive. Mm-hmm. Ivan Krastev was here last week at the Gallen Symposium, mm-hmm. St. Gallen Symposium. You were there too. We were all privileged enough to be part of that. And he said an important sentence during his speech. He said, it is not money nor artificial intelligence that wins wars, but humans do. Mm-hmm. And it could be, in a way, a shock of the old, just to remind ourselves that in the end, it is human beings on the ground who are deciding wars and are decisive for wars. Would you agree, or would you say, no, that's really in the past? It is not the human factor that will decide the wars of the future or of the present.
I wish I knew the answer. I don't know. I really don't know. And what I can say from my own lived experience is that war creates more suffering than one can possibly imagine. And it's not just for the enemy, you know, the opponents, but it's also for the entire civilian population that happens to be in that space. It's for the people on both sides of the conflict. I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder is real because you have these traumas, you are experiencing these traumas and you have to understand why it is that you're doing what you're doing. So that human element is critical, but when it comes to using robotic systems in warfare and how they will be applied in the future, I think it's up for debate and how that will change the way warfare is fought, what that will mean for ensuring security and peace. I don't think we know. I don't know. And maybe there is somebody who can answer that definitively. The other aspect of it that I would ask everybody to think about is, if you were in a conflict zone and you're not taking part in those hostilities, you're not a member of one faction or another, but you're a father or a mother trying to raise children in this space. You have nowhere else to go. This is the only place you've ever known. And then all of a sudden, your children get killed because an errant bomb hits them. It wasn't the intention of the soldiers or the system that dropped that bomb to kill your child, but it happened because terrible things happen in war. That's the idea of the suffering. How would you react? Would you become a militant? Would you be motivated to take the lives of other people? Would you want vengeance? Or would you be able to forgive? And that's another question that I don't know the answer. I think you can only answer that question after you've been faced with it.
Looking at your trajectory, it is kind of unusual for a classical academic, not so unusual, but in European terms, quite unusual. You enlisted free willingly by your own choice into the army. You also then became a member of the West Point Academy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you talked about the decision process of a young man or a young woman to join the army, to enter that field. What was it in your case?
So I joined in 1999, prior to September 11th, and I was very idealistic, perhaps naive, and I grew up really appreciating everything about my life in the United States. I had great teachers in the public school system. I had so many opportunities, and I thought that service was important, giving back to protect these freedoms, these institutions that I believe in so strongly.
So it was genuine patriotism, you could say.
I would say patriotism was a part of it, but beyond patriotism, it was a desire to give back in service to humanity. It was bigger than patriotism because I saw myself as living in a place where democratic ideals ruled and the rule of law applied, and that there were other people around the world who didn't have that. They didn't have the same opportunities. And so I thought, okay, the U.S. military is a way for me to give back, to serve both my country, but then also these values that and principles that I really believe strongly in.
This is very interesting, also, if I might say so, very touching, because from what you say, I get the sense it was kind of an existential thankfulness that drove you to the army.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Were there others like you?
Yes. Absolutely. I think that the majority of my West Point classmates, I can't speak for everybody, but I know that there was a lot of us that did it for idealistic reasons. It wasn't selfish. You don't join the military out of selfishness. It's a selflessness that drives people to join the military.
Because what you say is, I would say, miles and miles away from the stereotypical picture that we all have made up by movies and stories that we read, that it's about male heroism, what we may call today maybe toxic masculinity, that you want to prove yourself, become a hero, see where your limits are. This was not part of your, so to speak, decision setup.
No, let's, to be perfectly honest, that also was a part of it. It's also to test your limits, to see how far you can go in your physical stamina, in your endurance. You know, I definitely had, that was a part of me that, but, and that's where I think it's a bit naive because, I mean, it's not putting yourself through those kind of experiences is not going to test your masculinity. It might test your physical endurance or your ability to endure suffering and pain, but the ones that maybe are trying to prove their masculinity or maybe would be trying to prove something, those are the people that I wouldn't necessarily want to go on a mission with.
Do you feel that this is a type of people that are in charge right now? I mean, I think of Pete Hexas, for example, who would be almost a paradigmatic example of such a toxic masculinity in charge.
Pete Hexas is a person that I would not have gone outside the wire with. I don't know him personally. I've never met him, but seeing how he portrays himself, seeing how he represents himself, this is a person that if I was on a mission where I was planning a mission and he showed up and he was going to be augmenting my team, I would ask him to go and do maintenance on a vehicle and he would not be going on the mission because he's not reliable in that sense. You don't know if he's going to abide by the rules, the law of armed conflict. And frankly, like I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror at the end of my life and say, I did everything I can to reduce suffering, not to dehumanize people, not to treat people with disrespect because they have a different religion or the color of their skin is different than mine or their sexual preference is different than mine. I don't care. You know, everybody's trying to get by. Everybody's living is not always easy. There's ups and downs and we're all doing our best. So why make it harder for somebody if you don't have to?
25 years later, 26 years later, you enlisted in 1999, if I understood you correctly. You're sitting here and you're trying your best and actually very actively to formulate a binding framework for the rules of engagement in AI when it comes to warfare. And you also wrote a paper, I think, for the Swiss Armed Forces some years ago where you outlined such a program. Could you give us maybe the parameters or the guardrails of such a program as you would regard fit to meet the needs of our situation?
The key aspect of applying new technologies to warfare is that, one, you have to take the threat seriously. You can't dismiss it outright because the threat is real. There are people and groups of people that have nefarious interests. So if you want to live in a free country, with democratic principles, with liberty, with the all the values that I believe in personally, not under authoritarian rule, trusting my government, all of these things, you have to defend them. And that also means following the rules. So that's the first part. The second part is you have to be able to look at whatever system you're doing or developing or applying and figure out what principles you want to apply to the use and development of that system. So basically looking across the full life cycle of whatever it is that you're choosing to do. So if you're designing and developing and adopting a tool, you need to look at that process from start to finish and say, what principles are we applying? And then—
But that's the second part is ultimately an ethical or philosophical process.
Yes, absolutely. And it takes interdisciplinary conversations, which I think that's something that I mean, that is something that I have been pushing and working on since I arrived in this space, having conversations with programmers and engineers who are trying to build solutions to problems, but don't necessarily they've never been in combat. They don't know how these systems are going to be used. But wait, there's the third aspect of all of this is like, you can have principles, but principles are just an exercise in words if you don't operationalize them. And that's the hard part. Taking a principle and saying, we want transparency in our systems, or we want our systems to act reliably. These are valuable principles that should be applied to tools, especially if you're developing systems that are going to have a life and death effect. However, how do you take these ideas of transparency and reliability and actually operationalize them, make them real? That is hard.
And isn't it even harder now that we have systems that are not transparent to us?
Absolutely.
I mean, isn't that the main challenge then?
Yes, and that would take us all the way back to the very beginning, what I was saying about the human mind. I'm not sure that most of the time our own decisions are transparent to us. In the aftermath, after we do something, we can look back and say, oh yeah, I chose to do that because this and this and this. But these are post facto explanations.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the full truth. It's not the full story, because I can't see into my own mind and know exactly why I'm making all the choices I make.
But then the topic of this St. Gallen's Collegium this year is reinterpreting freedom.
Yes.
An idea would be that it's exactly that intransparency that we call freedom.
Yes, absolutely. Having the liberty to make choices and to live a life in a way that aligns with, you know, this is something that I tell all my students when we're in class, because they're grappling with this also. What tools do I use? When do I use a tool? Do I use it to summarize the reading that, you know, Professor Trussell, he assigned this reading. It's really long. It's going to take me all night. Or I could go out and party, and this AI tool will summarize it for me in 5 minutes, less than 30 seconds, actually, and then it'll take me 5 minutes to read it. The question then becomes, what are you doing with intentionality? Like, how are you, what intentional choices are you making about what systems you're using, how you're engaging with systems, what information you're sharing about yourself? And all of that can only come, that intentionality can only come if you actually stop to think.
But then this brings me to an interesting question, and I'm not really clear about it. I'm grateful that I can ask you that question. When we think of military training, mm-hmm. we sometimes have the imagination that it's about to make human beings into automats, that they don't think, but just act, that they don't hesitate, but just do. But if I understand you correctly, actually the ideal soldier is a soldier who's schooled in the faculty of judgment to exactly show that hesitation, to exactly think seriously about his doubts in a situation. But isn't there a real challenge to be as quick as you need to be and as reflected as you should be in these very situations that you describe?
It's a balance. On the one hand, it's like a sport where, and I know that you're a lover of football. Mm-hmm. So when you drill a pass and you're passing the ball back and forth, you do it thousands, 10,000, 100,000 times so that you know you don't have to think. It's in your backbone. You're in the flow. You kick the ball, you know exactly where it's going without having to think about it. And in sports, we do this over and over. That's where the repetition comes in. And there's that aspect of military operations where you do things so many times that you don't have to think through it. It becomes muscle memory. The phrase that we used in Ranger school, or that the Ranger instructors used with us, is slow is smooth, smooth is fast. You do things slowly, repetitively, and over time, because you've done it so slowly and so many times, it becomes boring, it becomes smooth, and that smoothness makes it fast. All that said, on the other side of it, from day one of being at West Point, they drilled into our minds, you have responsibility. as a future officer in the U.S. Army, with people's lives that you're responsible for, both civilians on the battlefield, enemy combatants, and your own soldiers, that responsibility was really driven into our minds. And you had to act with integrity because of that responsibility, what we call command responsibility. And that, the best commanders are going to be the ones that apply their judgment in a way that is taking that responsibility fully on their own shoulders. Because you're always going to be in situations where, you know, this is probably one of the reasons why the Russian military has done so poorly in Ukraine. I speculate. It's because they don't have that autonomous decision-making responsibility ingrained in their leadership. It's more, you take commands from an authoritative power, you follow those commands.
Blind obedience.
Blind obedience. And what happens? Well, you're not adaptive, you're not flexible, and you get killed.
Mm. Now that you described this training program, as it were, so vividly, is there any way to mirror that very training when it comes to AI? One would assume that repetition, repeating situations for AI is key, and at the same time, algorithmically, to enhance the faculty of judgment as we see it to the best of the abilities of the system.
I mean, that's a fantastic question, and I think you're getting into what is actually taking place especially in the space with regards to embodied artificial intelligence. And so when I refer to embodied artificial intelligence, that's robotics. So it's taking artificial intelligence and then having it in a physical system that interacts with our world. And that's probably where this is all going. Right now we're dealing with artificial intelligence systems that are operating in the cyberspace, and we have our tools that we can engage with, but they're not actually working in the physical world, maybe with the exception of drones and small drones being unmanned ground vehicles, unmanned aerial vehicles.
But truly embodied AI doesn't exist.
Embodied AI, this is robotic systems that you see that are being developed by a lot of different companies, and really this drive towards humanoid robotics, which raises its own series of questions. Is the humanoid form factor actually the best to build with? I don't know. But the idea of having an embodied AI interacting with the world, one of the ways that is being done is by creating artificial, basically online environments that incorporate aspects of physics, and then having the AI have the rules of whatever embodied system it is to try to learn how to act. And what they do is, because if you have one robot and you let it interact with the world the way a baby does, it can learn, especially if you're incorporating machine learning, it can learn how to interact with that world, improve its performance, maybe get better at walking, get better at climbing stairs. But if you take that same capacity and you don't actually have it in a robot in the physical world, but you have 100,000 robots in a online environment that mimics the real world, well, you just sped up your training process by 100,000 factor.
Fascinating. But that would also throw a new light on technologies that are on sale right now. For example, Google Glasses. Mm-hmm. I mean, one idea would be it's good for the humans who use it, but the other idea would be it's good for Google to access that very data to make the leap that you were talking about.
Yes, absolutely. There was a report that came out a couple of months ago. There are people in Los Angeles, I think, that are getting paid to wear gloves with sensors on them to just do routine tasks around their house, like doing laundry, folding the laundry, cooking food. And these systems are recording their movements all the time so that then it can be incorporated into the training of these AI models that will then go into robotic systems.
But are you telling me that each and everyone who wears Google glasses or different glasses of that kind is enabling the US military to improve its robotic sections?
That's a stretch. I wouldn't be able to say that.
But the tendency would be there.
The possibility is there.
So it's a dual use of data, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, data is a huge asset, and it's so important that we all recognize the importance of what we're doing with our own data. I mean, the common refrain that I hear a lot is, especially as soon as people understand that I work in the ethics of artificial intelligence and this space, they say, you know, is my phone listening to me, listening to my conversations? And I say, it doesn't need to. It may be, perhaps, but it doesn't need to. The amount of data that we are providing simply by having the phone with us, and that is why there's these pinpoint ads that arrive in our daily engagements with online activities. Because, you know, for instance, right now, do you have your phone with you?
It is here.
Yeah. So I have my phone as well.
Yes.
So now the companies that provide our phones, they know that you and I were in this room together spending time because the location data is available.
Yes.
And they might also see that you interact with someone else earlier today.
Yes.
And that person then went to a store and bought a certain thing.
Oh, I will get an ad saying, join the forces after this conversation.
Exactly. And it has nothing to do with them listening or surveilling our conversation. But the data, because these systems are so powerful, they're looking at correlations across data at speeds and scales that we cannot comprehend. It's multidimensional.
But it also means, and it's a very simple point to make, but it's important to make it, it's not a phone. And we fool ourselves with the very concept
it's
of
computer.
That being a phone. It's many things,
yes.
And possibly even a phone, but it's not right to address these devices as phones. It's a sham.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a powerful tool too.
Yes. Now, I don't deny it, but to call it a phone is ridiculous.
I agree. It's a data collection device.
Yes, yeah. It's many things. You outlined the three stages that would be needed to have a responsible use of AI in military and how complex that task really is. Mm-hmm. I guess a lot of people, and I would include myself, have a rather simplistic view of the army, the decisions taken there, the hierarchies in place. It would seem to me that it's the most demanding thing to do right now on Earth, and you would need the very best experts and minds to make that happen. Do you feel that the military in the West, I mean the US military, for example, but I ask myself also that question to Swiss military or German military, are up to speed when it comes to this? Do they have the best minds, or are they in touch with them, or do they lack the human capacities to deal with that very problem?
I can only speak from what I know about. I was involved with DARPA, that's the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And in that capacity, I was providing ethical, legal, and societal implications advisory services to technical teams that were building an autonomous decision-making system. So a tool that could be used for triage in austere environments to where there's no right or wrong answer. It's gray and really complex decision-making to make it align with human decision-makers that also are responsible for triage decisions. So in that sense, I've seen, and I know other people who have been what we call ELSI, ethical, legal, and societal implications advisors to the US military. And there is an effort, or there was an effort. I don't know what the state of that is now under the current leadership, but I do know that there are good people working on this with very good intentions and very thoughtful approaches to ethics and philosophy in the US. I'm worried about Europe in general, because there is this desire or need at this point to invest in the military. And there's also a hesitation because for decades now, it hasn't been important. There's been a lackadaisical approach to defense. And I think that it's easy to see this. It's evident.
It's also a lack of public support.
A lack of public support. And I understand why that is. But what that is creating is now there is a drive to invest in military structures and equipment. But there's also still the reluctance to engage with it fully, in the sense that having ELSI advisors in, you know, in the various militaries, looking at adopting these systems rapidly, before it's too late to be even relevant. And I think what we also see is that democracy is fragile. So how do you build and view the threats that are on the horizon in a way that is in alignment with your values? And it doesn't need to be aggressive or offensive. It's more about how do you defend what it is that you value, the liberties that you want to protect, in a way that aligns with your principles through conscious choices, intentionality, and integrity.
And these political choices will and have to be made by humans primarily.
Absolutely.
The machines won't take that from us. And
absolutely.
Nor should they. Dan, my last question, or almost last question to you, is this St. Gallen Collegium is made up of people that are somewhat in between, that have very special skill sets. And I would assume that your skill set right now, you must be drowning in possibilities. What to do next? What's your next step? Could be industry, it could be state, it could be probably any kind of advisor role. Like, what would be, from your perspective now, in 5 years, the best way to use your knowledge? Where would you see yourself and where would you like to apply it?
That gets to the heart of the matter for me, Wolfram, because when I accepted the fellowship here as part of the Collegium, I was part of the Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, which, if people hadn't heard about it before, they probably have by now.
Yes.
Because it was put into the wood chipper, to quote Elon Musk. And it no longer exists. So the agency where I was working as a humanitarian advisor was eliminated in February of 2025, or at least my job was eliminated in February 2025. So I have nowhere to go back to. And at the same time, the budget, the funding that USAID provided to the humanitarian sector was also eliminated. And I've heard numbers up to 70% of the humanitarian global budget was funded by the USAID.
Very serious consequences worldwide.
Worldwide. And so the sector where I have been working for a number of years as a practitioner, because I've always straddled the line between practitioner and academia, is gone. It's not gone. It's taken some very, very serious blows. And so I don't have a clear path forward. I would love to continue developing some of the work that I feel very passionately about with this idea of the survival chain. And to give credit where credit's due, this concept of the survival chain was actually a notion that one of my former bosses from USAID said, you know, we need to reframe this not as the kill chain, but as a survival chain. And so I've taken that idea and then looked at it. How do we apply these tools, these artificial intelligence systems that are so powerful to reduce suffering, to reduce civilian harm and conflict, and do it in a way that we can feel good about at the end of the day? And that, to me, is, you know, a project on humanitarian notification systems, which are mechanisms that humanitarians use to inform militaries where they are in a conflict zone, to say, hey, this is a convoy that's distributing food to a civilian population that is on the brink of famine. Please don't bomb us. We are not taking weapons to a militia. And these systems have existed since 1989, is the earliest case that I'm aware of, but they are ad hoc and notoriously unreliable. And right now there is a huge threat to international humanitarian law because it's being disregarded. So in my future self, if I look forward 5 years from now, I will have found a way to build a humanitarian notification system that makes the survival chain real.
That sounds beautiful. In philosophy, there's a concept called the great chain of beings. And it's a chain that goes on for billions and billions of years. And it is a survival chain and also a life chain that should go on this beautiful planet of ours. I hope this perspective becomes real for you. I think that would be a great service to the armed forces, to our culture, if we had such a thing as a survival chain. And my very last question, it's too trivial, but we have to do it because it's the ritual end to any conversation here at UNASENF. If you eat a sausage here in St. Gallen, will you eat it with or without mustard?
Oh man, depends on the day, how I'm feeling. If I need some spice in my life, I'll add the mustard. If I want to respect the local culture, I'll go without.
So we respect the local culture for today. And I thank you so much for your insight and for being here and having this conversation with us. Thanks so much, Dan Trusillo.
Thank you, Wolfram.
That was No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium.